Also, and I don't know if your headphones are like, I'm getting like a scratch.
I just got paged and my computer stole my headphones.
You're getting paged.
Is this better?
Yeah. You're getting paged right now.
Yeah, just got it. My phone stole my headphones from me.
do you need to?
No.
Do you need to go?
No. What was the last thing you said?
Welcome to the Better Incidents Podcast, where we hear from reliability-obsessed responders who are at the forefront of the movement to better manage, remediate, and learn from incidents. I'm your host, Robert Ross. We all understand that incidents cause a loss in revenue, but the camouflage cost of incidents can cause more damage than the immediate impact to revenue. What does the itemized receipt of an incident really look like? Today, I'm talking to MRZ, Senior Director of Production Engineering at Cowbell, about the hidden cost of incidents and a concept he uses called mean time to clue, or my preferred version, mean time to what the f***. All right. Well, we have one of my favorite people in the DevOps, SRE ops space. I don't know what we're calling it anymore, but MRZ, been at a bunch of big companies, now works at Cowbell. Why don't you quickly introduce yourself for folks?
Thanks, Robert. My name is Matthew, or I go by MRZ. I have been doing sysadmin to network engineer back to SRE, whatever we call it these days, for the last 20 some years. So I've seen a lot of good, I've seen a lot of bad, and I've seen a lot of breakages. And I think I've caused some of the breakages too.
Yeah. Were you an arsonist at a few points? Or
I may have been called that, yeah.
That's awesome. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now at Cowbell and really quickly what Cowbell is.
Sure. So Cowbell Cyber facilitates cyber insurance. So, you know, our primary users are either APIs hitting the platform or human brokers who are, you know, shopping to sell insurance. But the problem space is very similar. I think the last couple of places have been focused on production engineering or SRE or DevOps, whatever, which is for me the time an engineer commits code all the way through getting it into production and then supporting production. So while developers may be also on call, the SRE team there is there to help support. And then as a byproduct, when things break, how do we rally all the right people when things are on fire?
Yeah. I like that distinction. I like where you're saying, like, from moment of code commit to, you know, afterward, basically, like, that's the life cycle of the engineering department that you're focused on. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, like CI/CD, but mm-hmm. also thinking through what are the toolings that I need, the team needs to build so that you as an engineer can do your best work. Like, how do I get out of your way? Mm-hmm. Right. And then when we think about instrumentation, when a thing's broken, what do you need? What scaffolding do you need in place to make sure your test, your code goes to production safely? And if that's wrong, how do we back it out? And how do you know when to back it out? And can we automate some of these things?
Nice. Yeah, that's great. And are you still on call?
Yes.
You are?
I am on call.
Are you the last in line or are you the first in line?
So I participate in the rotation, but I'm also the last in call. So the way we've built it is that being on call should not be a punishment or a drag on you or your people around you. So if you're out walking the dog, you're out with your family and your primary and you can't take the call, don't. We don't keep score. So it rolls to a secondary. If the secondary is also busy, it eventually rolls to me at some point. And if I'm too busy, I'm the one who should be rallying others on whatever chat system we're using to go find someone to jump in. But there's no penalty for tapping out.
I like that. That's an interesting system. And I think we could have a whole discussion on that just alone. You know, first, in places I've worked, it definitely had a culture of if you didn't act the page the first time, for whatever reason, maybe you're on a date night or something, there was definitely some cultural consequences, is probably what I would call it. So you're on call. You have been doing this for 20 years. You care about, you know, CI/CD to the moment that things are out in the wild. And one thing that you and I were chatting about recently is there's a lot of these topics out there. There's a lot of these measurements. There's MTTR, mean time to resolve, resolution, whatever it might be, mean time to detect, mean time to acknowledge. There's all these MTT stars. But you have a special one And you have MTT WTF. And, you know, I'll spare the cursing here, but like, can you talk us through like what this particular measurement is to you?
Yeah, the PD version is mean time to clue. So I think when you're in the middle of an incident, there's two parts. Why did I get paged? And then how do I fix that? And so there's two parts. And so instead of focusing on mean time to resolution or mitigation, I've started separating them because I want to understand why are we in this room and how long does it take us to understand why we're in this room? And usually the answer is around better instrumentation or observability, right? But if it takes us an hour to debug the problem, that's just an hour of whatever the SLO or SLA looks like. And so when we do our retrospectives, we start tracking that one because it should be reducing.
So this mean time to clue, and you mentioned it's a lot of observability, is a reason why mean time to clue might be long, short, things like that. How are you marking that in time? Because when I was on call, there was plenty of red herrings. Maybe you see logs, log lines for exceptions, but maybe that isn't actually it. They just happen to correlate with the problem. Like, how do you define, you know, clue and red herring?
So I think in the fog of war, it's not really clear. We try to use Slack emojis to indicate this is an important line or part of the thesis we think we're following. It's during the retrospective write-up. So we sort of separate the retrospective write-up, which is like a mini interview where it's usually me or someone else who's sort of a third party, asks the team a bunch of questions. We write the retrospective, and then we do an engineering presentation. We'll kind of walk through the thesis and where we went wrong and where we went right. Like what did we do well? What could we have done better? Mm-hmm. Right. And so through those conversations, we kind of derive an idea of how long did it take us to understand the problem. So it's not a precise science, but it's more about questioning the team to understand how could we have understood the problem better. So was our thesis about Kafka correct? Well, it wasn't. That took time away. How could we improve the next time to disprove or prove that it was Kafka, for instance? We're on Kubernetes. So obviously every time there's a breakage, it's obviously Kubernetes, right? But how can we quickly disprove that it wasn't an EKS or a Kubernetes fault? Mm-hmm. So for the next time we can So can we quickly dismiss things and refocus the team? So it's kind of a conversation point, not pure metric-y.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like, I guess like the clue is not, we pasted a graph that showed us the problem in chat. It's when there's a collective agreement that, yes, that is like a path that we should go down. Is that maybe one way to think about it?
Yeah, because I think in the fog of war, you're testing a bunch of paths. And so you may be posting charts or URLs and they're directional, but then there is a point in time where like, yeah, this is actually the problem. Now we know how to go fix it. Otherwise, like, you don't know how you're fixing it, right? So that's kind of how we're tracking it. And it's not just metrics or observability. It's also, you know, shared documentation, not shared understanding. So just because I wrote a thing, did you understand what I wrote? Do you understand the service? Are you new and you haven't digested this new complex thing? And so, but you happen to be on call, right? So we try to think through, is it a training thing, a documentation thing?
Yeah, I like that because there's plenty of documentation out there about services for a lot of organizations. Whether or not it's stale, we can ignore that part. Let's assume it's correct. But is it a clue for the person that needs to do something, I guess, is kind of where I'm going with this. Because for me, if I was on call and I got paged and I'm just trying to debug something, I would grab screenshots from our observability and just paste it into, at that time, Slack and ask, does this mean anything sometimes? It's like, and I had the evidence, but it wasn't necessarily a clue just yet. Like I was still trying to figure out what that is. So what's that moment before mean time to clue? Like what is that to you? Do you have a different investigation period before that? Or are you just saying that's all part of mean time to clue?
I think I've kind of lumped it all together. I don't think I've separated out that piece yet.
Mm-hmm. And where does the timer start? You know, at page, at acknowledge. You know, where does it kind of begin?
So generally, when we create the incident channel, so we're using FireHydrant that carves out a Jira and a Slack channel concurrently. That's usually the start of the incident. We might back it up if because part of the retrospective is how did we detect the problem? Was it you know, CS customer support reported it or some other user reported it, that may actually be the start. But generally, it starts when the Slack channel was created or the Jira was created. So that starts the timer. And then there isn't really an investigation until the troops have arrived and they've started looking at stuff. And so we try to get the domain experts. You know, you wrote your service, you know it better than I do. You're in the channel first. And you can dismiss yourself. Like, it's not my service. I actually know it's this service. And you can, we have escalation paths so I can escalate to another team. And part of the idea is going back to how we're using on call is that I'm going to page you because my information suggests you're the right team. I could be entirely wrong. And that's also okay because you're going to help correct it. You're going to help steer us the right direction. And you're not going to get too annoyed that I mispaged you. And if that's incorrect, then we should try to understand what are the inputs into the system that caused me to mispage you too many times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And where you are right now, do you have multiple services? I mean, you said the word Kafka. I can only assume that you have multiple services running in production today.
We have multiple services running in production, in multiple environments.
Multiple might be underselling it based on that reaction there. So how are you defining, because we have mean time to clues, that's from the moment the instance starts to the moment you have, you know, your lead, let's say that. How are you defining like who gets involved in this, right? There's service ownership and you're mentioning that you're paging potentially the wrong person. Like how have you defined that? Is it the people that write the code, like you just said, those are the service owners. Those are always the ones that we're trying to page first. I'm just trying to understand like when someone's in the room, why are they there?
We'll have like a generic indicator that like ingestion is delayed. And so we'll first say, hey, it's an ingestion problem. The ingestion team should be involved in this. And they'll be the first responders. And they'll say, it's actually a Kafka problem, actually. Like, our code's working correctly. Kafka is the one that's returning errors. And so now we can, you know, now it's an infra problem. Or the ingestion team is fine. The clues that says it's an ingestion problem were downstream expecting data. And we're seeing a data delay that we thought was through ingestion pipeline. Right. So they'll be directional, like actually our dashboards show we're green and we now think it's the next snack down. Right. So it will re-escalate to that team. But a lot of it's, you know, instead of using the word root cause, like the contributing factors. So one of the contributing factors may suggest ingestion, or we have strong notion that it is an ingestion issue. And that's why that team gets paged first. And then over time, when we do the retrospective and we keep saying, hey, the ingestion team gets paged all the time and they dismiss themselves. Why is that? Like, what are the inputs in the monitoring platform, whatever, that's suggesting that? And can we be more precise? Mm-hmm. And the answer is always yes, right? Like, it's just, we just haven't thought about these questions.
Yeah, it's not wrong. And then that ultimately is driving down your mean time to clue, because now instead of bringing in the layer 7 team, they're going all the way down to the stack first instead of, you know, having this human intervention, I guess I would say.
Now, one of my core beliefs is that I can run like a 5.9s infrastructure on your 3.9s cloud, but I have to be really sharp at understanding the problem, detecting it, and then resolving it.
And how does your team know? I mean, this is, I'm about to ask you like a holy grail question, so I apologize for how broad this can be, but like, how do you even know what to measure and alert on at this point? Because, and I know that retrospectives are constantly going to be feeding back into what makes sense for us to be alerting on. But for net new things, you know, how are you and your team thinking about these are the core things that we're going to alert on, you know, just to start for this net new service?
Yeah, so the conversation usually starts off on a version of customer happiness. What makes you the customer happy? Like, why are you coming to me? Like, what are you paying me for the service? I should be measuring that, because if I'm not, you are. Right. So we try to think through. A couple years ago, I was at a place that had like a GUI-based Terraform, and so you'd press play, and it would deploy your infrastructure. And I asked the question, "Are you measuring successful deployments?" And they weren't. Like, well, your customer is. So you should probably measure from the time they press the button to successful deployment, right? So that was where we started the conversation. And then, so that was super high level. And then we start thinking about what are the things that could break that. And that gets, you know, then you go down the stack and on thing. I was at Wavefront to host a time series company. And the core value of the product was you could send data in and then look at the data. So ingest, query. So we measure that. We would send a data point every minute, and then every minute we would ask for the last 39 or 29 data points back, and that would determine if it was working. If that was not true, then we started going down, like, what is the database doing? And ultimately, we got down to the EBS volumes, because those are usually the constraint, right? So we had really fine monitors, but that was super low level at that point.
Yeah. No, I like that. And I mean, it's, I've been kind of starting to preach this more and more, is that we only build software for the people using it, right? And if we aren't, then maybe it's for fun. Maybe it's a hack day project. I always have leniency, sure. But if you're putting something in production, it should definitely be measured. The first measurement is it making someone happy, or are they, you know, satisfied? And that's like your first reliability score, right? They don't really care if how it's written or anything like that at first. But once they start using it, they start ingraining it into their workflows, whatever it is, then, you know, the reliability score is a combination of perception of the user and, you know, change failure rate. And maybe in your case with EBS disk pressure or something like that. So I like that as the first measurement. Like, the first thing you're always going to learn on is that customer happiness.
Yeah, I think Charity Majors has some phrase, like, nobody cares how many nines you have.
The nines don't matter if you cut. Yeah, exactly. It's a great quote. Let's talk about another thing that you and I were discussing recently, which was the cost of debugging an incident. So we have mean time to clue, we have mean time to WTF, which is my preferred acronym. Is it an acronym if it's two acronyms, actually?
I don't know.
Or is it two or one? I don't know anymore. Let's talk about the cost of debugging an incident, because I think what you're saying is all a part of that. There's the time that it literally takes to, you know, figure something out and resolve it that the customer is feeling. And then there's these other costs, like human capital, what you're paying out to your customers, like SLA refunds. Slack in 2018 had $8.2 million in refunds, and they had to tell investors, like, this won't happen again. And then there's opportunity cost. And you had a lot of great opinions on here, and I'm curious if you can expand on these. And, oh, and you also mentioned attrition. You know, are we burning people out to the point where they're like, nope, they just tap out of the company entirely?
Yeah, I think like the monetary loss is easy because you've signed some SLA, like the lawyer agreement piece. That piece is easy to quantify because if you don't quantify your customer, they'll ask you for the money. It's the inside stuff that I think is harder to quantify, that outside of those on call, you may not understand the human impact of it. So in the example I gave you, I may mispage the wrong team. Well, I took them away from something. And the human swapping cost between different tasks is not zero. So I paged one team and they're wrong, and they've escalated to another team. I've now involved at least two people, plus whoever is the incident commander on call, right? And it's not just one person. It's usually a handful of people from each team who come in. And then you're left with a Slack channel of 30 people in there. And that's now a very expensive Slack channel. And some people are idle, but there's a good portion of the channel that's actively debugging to dismiss themselves. And so when I think through the meantime to clue or MTD to WTF, part of it is I want to make sure I'm not blowing a bunch of people up in a room they don't need to be in.
I love what you said about that's a very expensive Slack channel. Yeah, I don't even know how to express how much I like that. Actually,
I mean, there's a couple dimensions, right? Like, I'm paying what are the cost of the human capital, but then the work they're not doing. See, I think we talked about like the opportunity cost of not doing that. There is some PM-driven project that is not getting attention because I just pulled a bunch of people into a room. And we've all rationalized that a P1 or a Sev1, whatever, is the most important thing, right? It is more important than whatever's in your sprint.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you every Sev1's an hour of your time. It may be half a day or maybe a couple of days.
And I think there's the other costs of an incident that are hidden here too. It's not just an engineering cost. I've been in incidents where the entire customer success and support team, that was like 130 people, had joined this Slack channel in addition to the engineers trying to solve the problem. And for those folks, they may not be technical, and no one is being nefarious in that channel. They're all trying to help. But every once in a while, I would see a support ticket get linked that was just completely not the same problem that we were trying to mitigate. And it's like, hey, is this ticket related? And then I have to open that ticket and click it. And then that person is also distracted. Now I'm distracted. So there's the engineers that are no longer maybe building a customer-facing feature, and there's the customer success in support as well. Is that something that you see? And like, do you have any ideas on how to solve that problem? Is it just always a private Slack channel? Like, how do you solve that?
Yeah, so I spent almost 8 years at Mozilla. So my mindset's kind of gravitates are open by default. So all these channels are open by default. And I think it just becomes more of a human, like a teaching moment, right? I say that because I actually want diversity of thought. I've been in instances where the person who found the smoking gun was not technical. They were part of the other business side, but they just happened to look at the data differently and ask the right question. So I want that diversity of thought. And I think that the incident commander's role then is to make sure that the communication is on point. So if Robert, you come in, you're asking like questions that aren't relevant, I might just DM you like, you got to back off. These guys are busy. I've done the same thing with executives to come in, just want to know right now what's going on. Like, well, it's not the right time. Yeah. Let's we're debugging it. And I think that's where the communication piece comes up. So using like an internal status page, which is unfiltered text, but internal people can consume that one, and that, you know, customer success can take that language for an external status page, for instance. That's where I see the incident commander really playing the role, making sure the team is focused, making sure that nothing else is in their way.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think about the idea of an incident commander having to basically take a short class on opportunity costs and like really understanding all of the additional, because I think that there's the responsibilities of the commander. Basically, you're an on-demand project manager. But at the same time, you almost have the role of being a financial person in a way, and maybe that's a stretch, but someone that's an incident commander should probably understand the actual costs of each of these random Slack messages coming in. And maybe it's not a dollar cost, but it is certainly it's cognition cost, certainly. Yeah. And do you train your incident commanders beyond just the on-demand project management work, or is there a program that you've developed for this?
I was in a formal program. So my last place, we had the incident commanders shadow. So we had the primary, secondary, and there's a shadow rotation. You shadowed and you just observed. So part of your training was to observe real world stuff, and you sort of learn by example. I think the challenge was to make sure you as an incident commander felt empowered to tell people no, or felt empowered to push other products off, or to demand someone's attention. Like, this is a sub zero. This is now your most important thing. And if you got blocked, you'd come to me or others to help on that piece. But that was a hard piece, right? Because like telling people no, or telling people to get out of the channel, those are different skill sets, right? In my last place, even here, we treated... we were really leaning into like the FinOps cloud econ stuff. And so if we saw an unexpected cost increase that may be expected or maybe a code defect, we would declare a SEV on those. And so after some number of instances like that, people were much more aware of the financial impact of a thing. And then we kind of teed that into, hey, we've got 30 people in this channel. Do we still need 30 people? Can we start dismissing people? Can you go back to your normal day job? So I think that it's part of that. It wasn't a formal type thing, but we were really focused on, you know, our Amazon spend or our Snowflake spend or our Elastic spend, whatever. And so anything that made it go up the wrong way, we had eyes on it.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that it's important to build that skill around saying no. It's extremely hard. Because it's also, you also don't have time to write out a message in Slack that's, hey, and, you know, really be, you can't provide a ton of detail because, you know, seconds matter in an incident. It really is kind of, you kind of have to be like, hey, so-and-so, the messages you're posting right now are not valuable to this incident. Please leave or resign yourself to wait until you have something more important to say. And it's not a mean thing. It's just, we're trying to do something right now, and you're costing us time. You're costing our brains more cycles to fix this problem.
Yeah. And in the middle of the incident, none of that's obvious. to first timers for sure. And so a couple places ago, when we started doing our retrospectives, we would do company-wide retrospectives. So it was a small startup with 200 people, so you could do it. But part of that was because we would talk about all the things. So, hey, maybe there's excess noise coming in from sales for some reason. They should understand this, and we should improve all parts of the business. Like maybe sales shouldn't join the channel just because, or maybe we should rethink through how we communicate to sales on something. Because the problem space then was sales is doing a demo, and the demo is broken because of something else is broken. So how they do a successful demo, right? So we can kind of rationalize through what that might look like for that use case instead of just asking a bunch of questions in Slack. We also found that sometimes the issue was we developed a feature, we miscommunicated to customer success, and they misinterpreted that to the customer. So the way the customer used the feature was not what we thought, whatever, broke stuff, right? So part of the whole retrospective was, again, what did we do well? What could we have done better? And some of it's, right. Most of it's around communications.
Yeah. And I love that idea of, you know, presenting a retrospective to the whole company. It's so simple, but so effective, because I think that a lot of people that aren't in the engineering product design organization probably find that stuff very interesting. And it's also very valuable from a business point of view if we're thinking about the cost of incidents. You know, you might only need to do that one time on an all hands where an engineering manager can say out loud to the entire company, we had too many people in the channel and it took us longer to get to a clue because we were fielding too many questions. And I think it would be very powerful. And it's not a guilt trip. Well, maybe it is, but it would help certainly in the next incidents too, I think.
Yeah, I think it's also, I think the reason I started doing it that way was as a SRE, you know, DevOps engineer, no one really knows what you're doing. They only really know you when there's like a catastrophic outage, right? So by having these, the whole company got a perspective of what the team actually does and some of the problems they're facing. We also got that, again, that diversity of thought. And I think I like what you said. Like we weren't there to place blame. We were trying to understand what was the inputs into you asking these questions. You're asking a bunch of questions, but like, why? Do we need to inform you better? My last place for the executive team, it was a 15-minute emails. And they had a summary. They wouldn't jump into Slack. They would stay out of Slack.
Yeah.
Or stay off the Zoom call. And I'm sure you've been in a place where your C-level person jumps on a Zoom call and the whole nature of the call changes now.
100%. There's a hesitancy that comes with executives being on the call. Now you might not have, and it really boils down to psychological safety. And if you have a non-technical exec and you say the words, I'm gonna restart the database, like that sounds scary. It might be the exact right thing to do, but to a non-technical exec, that's terrifying to hear.
Yeah. The converse is true, too, because you have a very technical C-level person who says, you should do this. Most people do that, and it may not be correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and speaking for myself, I mean, I FireHydrant's a relatively small company. I'm a technical executive, and I just stay out of it because I've been that engineer that had all of a sudden the worst thing that happened to me is I would get text messages because I was I was at the company for a long time, so I had those relationships with the executives and I was still on call. So I would get a text message, hey, it looks like our site is down. It's like, well aware. And now I need to reply to this message on my phone, and it's, you know, just even more costs to the incident. So to any executives that listen to this, I know that the site being down is bad, but you don't need to be in that Slack channel or the Zoom bridge. I promise you, you're slowing down the response and you're costing your company more money than you think. Well, with that, any final thoughts here? Because we talked about the mean time to clue. We talked about getting the right people in the room and the cost of it. And I'm just kind of, for those that are implementing an incident response program, either at a new company or an old company, what's a piece of advice, since you've done this a couple of times, that someone can take away?
I mean, I think every time I've done it, I've focused on one thing first. And both times it's been, or last three times it's been, when something breaks, how do we get focused attention on it. Everything else came after that. So the retrospectives grew on top of that. The idea of formalized roles grew on top of that. And that became because I now had, I had enough people in the room where I needed to actually do an interviews. So then we had an incident commander who could then feel empowered. And part of it was when the company is like 10 people, you don't need any roles. You're all in it together. So I always try to think through, again, how do I get the first set of first responders focused on the problem? And then we build on top of that. I'd add one more thing too. I think that part of the reason I started doing this was I wanted to avoid burnout from people, which would, you know, whatever, people leave because they get burned out. So how do I bring attention to an issue, and how do we take that? Like, as a human, I want to see that a problem broke and that it's not going to happen again. The next time we have an issue, it's a brand new problem. And the excitement might be the hunt of the new problem, not I'm just doing a fix of the same thing again. Right. So as we grew from rally the first responders to retrospective, it was what are the set of jurors or tickets do we do to prevent this type of class of problems from happening again?
Yeah. And I think that's, it just feeds it right back at the beginning, right? That's once you lay all that out and you're, it's just this machine that you can start to turn more and more and more, yeah, and ultimately start just achieving more reliable software.
Yeah. People like to, I've been in places where people believe that.
Also, and I don't know if your headphones are like, I'm getting like a scratch.
I just got paged and my computer stole my headphones.
You're getting paged.
Is this better?
You're getting paged. Yes, it is. You're getting paged right now.
Yeah, I just got it. My phone stole my headphones from me.
do you need to?
No.
Do fine. You need to go?
No. What was the last thing you said?
I don't know. I'm what I asked. I was saying that you know, once you have this machine going, getting the right people in the room doing retros and you're assigning roles, and then it's a crank of the wheel each time, and then eventually the wheel just kind of like takes on itself and it starts building and improving the software over time. At least that's my opinion. Once you have a good cadence of things.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it ties into so one of the OKRs I wrote for myself for this calendar year was a culture of excellence and a culture of continuous improvement. So all these things feed into that one. And I don't, like, it's continuous. They're never done. We're never done with the alerts we set up in Grafana, right? Because every time we have a thing, we think there's a better way to alert on this one, or there's a more refined alert, or we try to think through, can I put as much debugging into the alert? So when the alert fires, it's telling me there's a binary thing. It's just one thing that I have to go do. And you never get there on day one because you only know what you know, right? So we started doing pre-mortems at one point to kind of think through failure cases we hadn't thought of. That's great. And then you go to production and then the thing breaks. And then the post-retrospective is to think through what other alerts should I have had in place. And at this point, I now have a bunch of data points that were leading indicators or contributing factors.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the pre-mortem, the safety checklist, production readiness checklist, all of that is something I think a lot of companies should start including in their timelines as well. You know, do a full-on couple-hour meeting of this is how I think this software could break. Here are the seams in it that might leak things. Here's, you know, the alerts that we care about from a customer happiness point of view. But, you know, we've put stuff into production that brand new stuff that we just like, let's just see error rate. We don't think it's going to be right initially, but we don't know what else to check yet. So let's just, error rate is it for now. And we'll start filtering on error rate at a certain point, but like we need a baseline of where to start.
I think that's right. So the pre-mortem is, hey, Robert, tell me about the service you're going to put into production. Tell me what is the healthy version of your service look like? And we try to craft a dashboard that helps us understand it's healthy. From that, we start to understand what unhealthy looks like, or like basically staring at a bunch of lines on a dashboard make us understand what we should alert on. But it really isn't until we start getting it load where we understand, oh, our assumptions were wrong here, or we were totally right here, but we're looking at it the wrong way.
I think it's an interesting point too, is because sometimes you don't even know what to instrument in an app, right? It's easy to instrument, you know, API errors or something like that, but there might be a totally different thing that you're not able to instrument easily, that, you know, getting interrogated by the SRE team will make you go, oh, I'm missing a metric that for this failure case that no one's going to know how to figure out what's causing that, right? And I think that's a good one. So pre-mortems, making sure you do those, you know, and when you rolled things out, you just focus on one thing. You're focusing on just making sure there is an incident, and then doing a retro for that incident, and then assigned roles for that incident, and then kind of feeding it back into the software lifecycle. I think those are all pretty good tips. Well, I think that is a great way to end this. And I hope that page you just got isn't, you know, going to escalate further. But thanks so much for taking the time, even while you were on call.
Just Kafka consumer lag. No big deal.
Just Kafka consumer lag. Yeah. Your standard day for what you're doing. Well, thanks so much, MRZ, for joining.
Thanks, Robert.
Always a pleasure. And, you know, catch you on the other side.
Bye, everyone.
The Better Incidents podcast is lovingly nurtured by the team at FireHydrant and made possible with generous contributions from the Better Incidents Collective. Learn more at betterincidents.com.